All right, everybody, welcome to the show. The season's over. Indiana rules. I'm Pap 40. This is Others Receiving Votes. I'm joined, as always, by Gene Wojciechowski and Brian Fisher as we put a bow on one hell of a season. Incredible, guys. And let me just first set the rules of engagement here. Brian and I caught the 3 a.m. bus leaving the stadium, got back to the hotel in Miami, had like 7 minutes to get something to eat before they threw us out of the hospitality room. I went upstairs, packed, and went to the airport. I have not slept. Brian could not have slept very much either. So, Gene, no pressure, carry us.
I had a wonderful evening of rest. And I feel refreshed, and I'm ready to go. I don't understand why you guys aren't.
I'm glad you're ready to go, because we got a lot to talk about. I have very little in terms of a formal rundown here, because we don't need one. We just know that Indiana went 16-0 and won the national championship, and none of us have ever seen anything like it. So we're going to talk about the playoff championship, the Indiana run, the game, the Mendoza leap, everything that we saw in Miami and what we've seen all season. And we're just going to freeform it. So I want to get your basic thoughts, just what was going through your minds. Gene, especially you, because Brian and I were sitting next to each other, so we had a basic idea what was going through our minds. But when you were watching all of this transpire Monday night,
I couldn't decide if I was watching a classic or if I was watching a collection of classic moments. But the more I thought about it, the more I think it truly was a classic game. Maybe not in the purest sense. It was a bit uneven at times. The officiating was inconsistent. There were mistakes. There were interceptions. There were penalties. There were penalties that should have been called that weren't. There was an entire quarter where our Heisman winner didn't complete a pass. And yet, when you really go back and think about it, I thought it was it's going to be a game people remember. And you can't always say that about national championship games. And yes, I know we're going to dissect the game itself as this podcast goes on, but big picture feeling, I just, when I turned off the TV and got ready to have a wonderful evening of rest and relaxation, I just thought we had all seen something memorable, and maybe the game wasn't as memorable as other championship games, but what it meant and what it signified and the characters that were involved in this game were what I'm always going to remember about that night, that game, those moments, and its place in college football history.
That's a wonderful summation. You did get some rest. Yeah. It shows. Way to be ready.
Yeah, very nicely, you know, put together and coherent, unlike the two of us who certainly did not have much rest. It was amazing to be on the field last night and just to look up at the boards to say, you know, national champions and have that Indiana logo on there. I mean, that of all the things that you could have said to somebody 2 years ago, even a year ago, you know, like that would have been almost incomprehensible to think that Indiana, this program, which was the losingest in all of college football coming into this season, would wind up a perfect 16-0, the first time since Yale in the 1800s, which is saying a lot, not just about the sport and what the road you have to go on to get to this point. But, you know, the thing that struck me was just, you know, being we've been in those locker rooms before, and they've always been, it's so excited, and they would talk about the journey, but there's just such an earnestness of from those players. You know, they enjoyed the journey to get here, and they were appreciative of what it took to get here. And how they got here, you know, talking with, you know, the defensive MVP, Mikel Kamara. I mean, he was a guy who was recruited to JMU when they were in FCS school, you know, and he talked about playing at that level and in the group of five. And now he's in the Big Ten, and now he's on the national championship making plays like that punt return. And It was just a crazy collection of moments. And you know, to Gene's point, I mean, I was appreciative that it was a good game. We've been to so many of these national championship games, and so often they do seem to be one-sided. And for a moment there, you know, especially after, you know, Miami or Indiana had jumped out to that 10-0 lead on Miami, and kind of thought, all right, this could be danger territory. This could get away from them. This could turn into one of those one-way traffic type of games. And it didn't. And we got some classic moments. We got a classic second half. There was tense, you know, there was quite a bit of tense people there amongst the Indiana and the Miami faithful at Hard Rock. And, I think looking back at it, I think I will remember just the joy that everybody had there at the end of the day.
Yeah, I mean, it was fantastic. Truly one of the best things I've covered. Not, you know, I mean, the Indiana run has been just this succession of aha moments of where they just kept proving themselves over and over and over. And yet at the end, to your point, I mean, to look up at the scoreboard and it says Indiana National Champions is like, that's the final aha, the final reveal. And they did have to earn it. I mean, Miami made them earn it. They did not get mowed down like Alabama. They did not self-destruct like Oregon. They hung in there and made this a heck of a game that then, you know, turned on a couple of extremely memorable moments. And I think the Mendoza leap will be one of the iconic plays in college football history. We'll get to that. But, you know, the thing with the Indiana story is it embodies all the sports lessons and the life lessons and all those things, you know, that people want to get out of sports, right? Or the things that people say are the redeeming values of athletics. It is, you know, it required belief, extreme belief, like Ted Lasso level belief, but that was fiction. This is real. Optimism, the hard work that goes into making Indiana into something it had never been. And then with this team, the selflessness and the camaraderie and the joy that they played with that I think were not just side effects. They were necessities because they're not as talented as a lot of other teams we have seen. As Kurt Cignetti pointed out last night, we're not going to have 8 first-round draft picks. They'll have one, maybe a couple, I don't know. But they've got some pros, but this is not a stocked roster of professional talent. These are guys that had to come together the way they did and play to a sum that was greater than their parts. Or they couldn't have done it. They really couldn't have. I mean, there were many times I thought in the game that I looked, Miami was bigger, stronger, faster. And key points. The first or second play of the game, the right guard for Indiana got absolutely tea-kettled. I mean, he got blown backward like he was an eighth grader playing in a varsity football game, high school. It was just like, I was like, oh, boy. Oh, boy. And then you saw when they got Malachi Toney loose in space, like Indiana doesn't really have guys that run quite like that. So to beat a team with that kind of talent and to beat a team with Oregon's talent and a team with Ohio State's talent, to me, this is one of the ultimate coaching jobs and just teamwork jobs. And so that part of it, to me, really makes the Indiana story, you know, something kind of almost on a different pedestal.
You know, if I can just add one last thing, and I'm joking about the getting a good night's sleep. I was actually very jealous of you guys because you're going to be able to say, as were all those people in that stadium, I was there. I was there when history was made, and there was history made last night. And I think one of the other reasons why I enjoyed it so much was it wasn't, and this is no knock on, I'm just throwing these two teams out there. Let's say Ohio State and Alabama in a national championship game. Those fan bases, that's almost a given that in your lifetime, you're going to be part of that. At Indiana, that wasn't even comprehensible. And so last night, to see these fans in that moment, to see the fans at Assembly Hall go nuts after the interception, basically to end the game, to see joy. I mean, just unfiltered and pure joy about something they never thought was possible become possible, was just, I think that's what really made it more special than just about any other game we've ever seen, because it was so new and fresh and real to a fan base that had never even given itself a chance to think in those terms. And now they're national champions.
Yeah. Amazing. No, the fan base element of this cannot be overstated. I think, as you said, they embrace this thing like crazy. And yeah, there's a good percentage of them that are saying, I was there in the lean years, and they really weren't, because those stadiums really were pretty empty. But they're there now, and one of the reasons they didn't come is there was going to be no reward for it. You pay to go see them get their teeth kicked in for decades. So to the way that the Indiana fans have just rushed in to embrace this thing is incredible. I looked up, they averaged a school record 51,000 in attendance this year. They had more than 51,000 at the Rose Bowl. They had more than 51,000 at the Peach Bowl. If they could have gotten more than 51,000 in for a Miami game in Miami, they would have. But as it is, they still had more fans there. I mean, it's one of the most incredible fan displays I've seen. You know, for Miami to not have a home game in their home stadium was shocking. And then just the total onslaught in the other two places. And then, yes, the scenes from Bloomington, Kirkwood Avenue, like actually looking like it had been invaded. I mean, just this mass of people there. It was spectacular. So I'm very happy for that fan base and what it means for them, and what I think it at least allows other fan bases to aspire to.
Well, it's broken the sport, right? You know, going on this for Indiana, the losingest program in FBS of all time, to win the national title, to go 16-0, it has broken a few people's brains. And we kind of saw that, you know, really the last couple of weeks of the offseason, you know, the number of coaching firings that have gone on, the amount of portal tampering that we've gotten, the amount of money being thrown around in the sport. Like, people are still coming to grips with this being a story. And, you know, the Kurt Cignetti standard, if you will, that's going to be applied to a lot of coaches moving forward. Like, that is going to be a big thing, I think, in the sport, not just at Indiana, but you know, Lincoln Riley, if you're at USC, you know, why are you year five now? Why is this still going on when Indiana of all places does that? You know, Lane Kiffin, you know, down there at LSU. I mean, you don't think those fans are going to say, hey, 2 years, buddy, like that's the standard now.
No, I mean, there's no doubt that this is going to, I think it was it Cignetti said today, Tuesday, that it's a paradigm shift.
Yep.
Yeah.
In terms of what's possible. And, you know, I think he's right. And we'll see who else can capitalize on it. But everybody can at least think about it and try to figure out if you can find the ultimate unicorn coach out there and find this ultimate gamer, former two-star Yale commit quarterback who's going to turn into a Heisman winner. And he is an NFL first-round draft pick without a question. Yeah, it just feels like we're in a new sport. We just kind of stumbled through this prism onto this other side where, oh my gosh, all these other things are possible. But I want to ask you now about how good the Indiana team is by history's yardstick. I just said, I mean, I do not think they have overwhelming talent, but they play with overwhelming teamwork and efficiency, and that's the most important thing. The ancient saying, hard work beats talent when talent doesn't work hard. That is a hardworking team that masks whatever talent deficiencies it had. So for the record, they finished 16-0. As Brian said, we haven't had that since the 19th century. They never trailed in a playoff game. They never had a turnover in a playoff game. They led the nation in turnover margin. They're second in fewest penalty yards. And I just looked it up. They went 16 games without ever having 50 yards in penalties in a game, which to me is crazy. I'm going to have to do some research to find the last team that, that could say that for a 15, 16, 14 game season even. They were dominant at times. They killed some good teams. So is this an all-time great team? What do you guys think? Gene, any thoughts?
You know, you don't think Vince Young, Texas. You don't think Cam Newton, Auburn. You don't think some of the great Bama. I mean, you can keep on going back. Nebraska teams with Tommy Frazier. But if you're asking me who might be the greatest team, and you just made all the arguments for it, I wouldn't have a problem if you said, that's my choice. I use my choice as the greatest team that there's ever been. You know, someone asked Steve Sarkisian before the season started. I saw this on Twitter this morning and said, do you think that there'll be a 16-0 team? And he said, I don't think so. And he mentioned something about, and if there are, that team needs a statue built for it. Well, guess what? They better start building a statue in Bloomington for that coach and that team. Mendoza is he doesn't look like it. He doesn't necessarily throw like it. He doesn't act like it. But he's one of the great college football quarterbacks. I mean, Tim Tebow-ish. I think you can make that comparison. You mentioned the is that what they're calling it now, the Mendoza Leap? You're going to be able to buy
the early favorite, I think, for the
yeah. So one. Go into the IU bookstore not too long from now, and there's going to be some artist who has done it. It's going to be framed. You're going to be able to buy it, and it's going to be in the basements and dens of so many Hoosier fans. It's going to be the greatest piece of artwork, college football artwork, you've ever seen. So. Yeah, I have no problem with saying that is one of the great teams you will ever see in college football because of what it accomplished and how it accomplished it. And I think there's a lot to be said for a team that, you know, as he said, the sum is greater than its parts. And because of that, that's why I believe in what you're saying. That's why I think you can really make that argument.
I agree completely. I don't, you know, if you were, you know, playing a video game and they had, you know, the NCAA video game at the media hospitality room and, you know, people would play it and they'd pick random teams and all that, you know, you would probably, talent-wise, you'd pick 2019 LSU. You know, you would pick those Nebraska teams, LSU, the USC yeah. teams. I mean, you would pick other teams if you're talking about just pure talent, what they put together. Yes, and a lot of undefeated seasons included in that. But, you know, Gene, to your point, I mean, the execution factor. I mean, this team played almost perfect football. You know, they led for 152 out of the 180 minutes that they played in the playoff. You know, Pat, you had all those. They scored in 60 of their 64 quarters this season, which is, you know, unfathomable. You think blowouts, you know, you have a slow start with the first team. I mean, to score in all but four quarters over a 16-game season is pretty impressive. You know, just the dominance that they displayed, you know, whenever they needed to play, they had that back shoulder working. You know, they would that was an unstoppable play. You know, and we've seen, you know, back shoulder throws all the time in college football, but this was a level from Mendoza to Becker to Cooper to whoever it might be. This was a level of perfection on that play that you know will be hard to top. Like that is teach tape, as a lot of those assistant coaches will like to say that they will be putting on in meeting rooms across the country. And that just kind of adds to this legend. I mean, if you were walking the field pregame like us, you know, and you were just walking those Miami sidelines as they were warming up and you're walking by the Indiana players, you know, you would be putting a lot of money on Miami to cover this game and maybe even win it outright. You know, that there was definitely a talent disparity, but the execution factor, that was what played into Indiana winning this, not only the way they did, but you know, the way they were able to execute throughout the season. And that does lend into not just how they did this and how they made this run, but it adds to their legend. You know, I think everybody understands this was not the most talented national champion of the last 20, 30, 40, 50 years, but they are one of the best, not only on the numbers, but based on what they were able to do between the lines.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing, is it's just the what does it take to win games? Everything they did. And if you, that's the teaching tape, really. It's just the whole thing. We're going to block punts when we need to block punts. We're going to cover kicks. We're going to, you know, we're going to make field goals. We are going to get hard yards running when we have to. And then, yeah, the back shoulder fades, the stop fades were, that was like Aaron Rodgers to Devontae Adams for a while with the Packers. Like that level between Becker, who is the roommate of Fernando Mendoza, and him. And that, you know, that's the things that make Mendoza to me an NFL guy. The accuracy and the arm talent. His motion isn't perfect. It's not Aaron Rodgers' delivery, but still the accuracy, the arm strength, but then just the intelligence too of knowing how to play and then rising to the occasion when you absolutely have to, which again, we will get to in a second. But I guess kind of where I landed on this, it is absolutely an all-time great team. I haven't had a chance yet to figure out, is it number one, number three, number five, whatever. Hopefully I'll get to that at some point in time. But here's what's undisputable in my opinion, all the more so now. Kirk Cignetti did the greatest job coaching we have ever seen, full stop, period. It's mind-boggling. Again, to go to Indiana and to do this, but the leap forward that this team made from the best team in school history last year, and this team was better, dramatically better, and the stuff they did and the way they won, even the games when they were under duress, they found ways to win, but there weren't even that many of those. And as I said, in the playoff, you know, I think everybody was like, well, we'll see now. They're number one seed. A lot of pressure. Is the moment going to be too big for them? No, it never was. It never, ever was. And the one moment when it was a crisis, Kurt Cignetti made, you know, one of the calls of his career, maybe certainly to this point, the defining call of his career, and then the defining play. But I want to get any thoughts you guys have just on Cignetti and this job and within the realm of history.
Well, I went back and looked at his very first game at IU. I think they beat FIU, and they beat them soundly. And after the game, one of his first comments were, you know, we've got a lot to work on, but one of the things we have to work on is keeping fans in their seats after halftime. And now fast forward to now. So that's not going to be a problem ever again, as long as he's there. He has just changed. And it doesn't happen that often. And I guess the most recent would be someone like Saban, someone who just changes everything, changes the way you feel about an entire program, changes the way the administration approaches your program. I know Brian, during this whole season, has talked about alignment, you know, the president, the athletic director, the head coach. That's what happened at IU. And it happened to perfection. And so, you know, when Sarkisian's talking about statues, well, you know, Cignetti has to be the first guy to pose for one. But I just think that the trickle-down effect of whatever he brings, and I'm not sure I can explain it, but whatever he brings was, we saw it. It was right in front of us. And it went beyond being down on the field and looking at Miami, the size of Miami's offensive line, and looking at the size of IU's players. It doesn't matter. That is the gap that he bridged. He made those things not as important. And I can't explain how he did it, but he did it. And from a practical standpoint, he just made himself a lot of money. He got $2 million bonus for winning that game. And they have to renegotiate his existing contract, and he got a $93 million extension. They have to renegotiate his existing contract where he's among the top three highest paid college football players. So from a monetary standpoint, it was an amazing thing. But way beyond that is just he did something that nobody has ever done before, and that's incredible. And I loved his attitude, and I loved seeing him down in the field, and he had that little piece of a red confetti stuck to his neck on a sweaty neck or his Gatorade-drenched neck, and it just seemed all so perfect.
You know what? You bring that up, and it just immediately makes me mad because I wrote that down, and I was so excited to get that in my story. He had a piece of red confetti on his head and a piece stuck to his neck, and guess what? It's not in the story.
That's all right.
I wrote 2,200 words, and I felt like I barely scratched the surface. That's how good this story is. But, no, to your point, he's not going to be top three. He's going to be number one. I would have to think he will be the highest-paid coach in the country after this. If it takes a Mark Cuban kick in or whatever, it's going to happen. Yeah. Anyway, Brian, your thoughts on Sig?
Well, I mean, you know, who would you rather take over him at this point? You know, I'm sure we'll get to some off-season, good off-season content down the road when it comes to ranking our coaches and who we might have up there. But there's nobody I'd rather have in college football right now running my program than Cignetti. You know, I mean, they're 27-2. That's the best record in all of college football since he took over. You know, he has a national champion. He is 16-0 this season, and author of one of the greatest turnarounds in the sport. But, you know, I think it was almost magnified, you know, the difference that he made during this playoff run. I mean, you look at Ryan Day and that opener against Miami in the Cotton Bowl, you know, the turtling almost, when he, in the Big Ten championship game, you know, the big moments that Ryan Day has fallen up short against Michigan. You know, there's no proof that Cignetti has any of that in him. You know, his two games that he's lost, you know, they were significant underdogs and they still played, you know, those two losses close. You look at Kirby Smart, certainly losing in the Sugar Bowl for the second straight year to a team that didn't have their had coaches shuffling back and forth at Ole Miss, you know, during that week and had, you know, a true program in chaos. And they had a big second half lead that they just let slip away versus, you know, Cignetti. He found those right buttons to push. It wasn't just calling those right timeouts and telling them to go for it. You know, when I was in his office this spring, you know, he was going through every red zone play that not only Indiana had gone through, but pretty much the rest of the country, you know, trying to find those little things that would make a difference. And his staff this week, you know, that they put in that QB draw that Fernando Mendoza scored on fourth down. And they had a lot of debates on what would be the best way to accomplish this. That was not really something in their playbook. They had run some things along those lines at times, but nothing like what they, in terms of formation and all that, that they did there in the goal line. He understands football to a great degree, but he understands how to communicate that to the kids. He understands how to get everybody on the same page. And he has gotten the buy-in. The alignment is there at Indiana from the top, but it's also taken, you know, some pushing by Cignetti. I mean, he understood that, hey, I'm going to have to go out and say things. I'm going to have to say the Google me line. He's going to have to say those things that gets others outside of Indiana kind of, oh, somebody said that. Oh, okay. And I think that is, he's very holistic thinking in terms of the program, but also the minor details that you need to have on game day. And so if there's another coach out there that you'd rather have other than him, I would be all ears, because I don't think there's anybody better right now in college football than Kurt Cignetti.
Yeah, here's the great news for Indiana. One, Cignetti says he's not an NFL guy, so you can take that off the board. Two, he said last night, you know, I guess I should probably retire, but I'm not going to. I don't really do anything else. I'm a football coach. That's what I do. You know, I want to break down film. So he's staying at Indiana, and he's not looking to retire. It doesn't sound like anytime soon. So the Hoosiers, like your dream run, has an excellent chance of continuing. It's amazing. And I do think, I mean, he has given them a decided coaching advantage in maybe every game this year, probably every game this year, and especially the big games. And that's hard to do. And it's hard to say. But that leads me to the big decision for the big play, the fourth down and five. With 9 minutes left in the game. And I wrote like 800 words just on this play because I thought it was so fascinating. They're ahead by 3 points. They can kick a field goal and go up six, but obviously it's still a one-score game against a team that had found its rhythm. And Miami was gashing them on the ground, and they were getting receivers in space, and they were moving, and they were scoring. It was 17-14 at that point. Fourth down, five. They send the field goal unit out. And then Cignetti calls timeout, and I thought it was because they were late on the clock. And I even said to Brian, I said, why call timeout? Just take a delay of game.
Take the 5 yards, yeah.
And kick from 5 yards further back. But then we're going to kick. And he said, get the offense back out there. We're going for it. And then they line up to go. And, I mean, it was a big gutsy decision right there. And then the play call, I think, took additional guts because you have the most efficient quarterback in the country and you have three elite receivers. And you say, now we're going to have the quarterback run. And you call the quarterback draw. And they have done some good red zone quarterback draws. But to Brian's point, Cignetti said that they had a 45-minute discussion about how to block this red zone quarterback draw. That's attention to detail. And the way they decided to scheme it, they were four wide, and they had Kalon Black next to Mendoza, the running back, and he led through, and he hit the linebacker, and Mendoza followed. And the, you know, part of the beauty of Fernando Mendoza, you know, I mean, he comes across as this goofy, kind of dorky guy, and when you see him run, he looks even goofier and dorkier. But it's just one more thing that he can do. He's like a baby giraffe trying to elude prey or elude predators. You know, he just kind of, he's all over the place. His legs are splaying. He does not move fluidly. He is not Vince Young running the football, that's for sure. But he gets past the initial, gets past the line of scrimmage, makes a cut, kind of jumps over the legs of his center. And then it's on. After that, it is just a blood and guts football play. Incredible. Blows through a linebacker, knocks him 2 yards backwards on his ass, and then makes the lunge for the end zone. The John Elway lunge, and he gets blasted in the back and lands in the end zone with the play people are going to talk about forever. I just want your thoughts on that play and Fernando Mendoza and his ability to rise to the occasion. Gino.
Well, first of all, you had to somehow, you know, crowbar a Denver Broncos reference in there.
Hey, it was an Elway play. It was Elway against the Packers.
I thought we were going to have to do a wellness check on you this past weekend, by the way.
But Gene, believe me, a lot of folks after the game on Saturday, we were checking in on Pat. And
I was unwell.
Yes.
I was unwell.
To say the least.
Well,
They're playing in the AFC Championship, so just – you'll be fine. But Mendoza, let's start off with the pregame. How'd you like to be Mendoza and you maybe glance around and then there's Tom Brady out there looking at you, the owner of the Las Vegas Raiders, other front office staff members there, and they're all there to watch you because they're thinking of taking you number one in the upcoming draft. No pressure there, right? he had an uneven game. If you really go back and look at it, started off fast. And then in the second half, Miami made the adjustments. They get the cornerback back. They hurry him on his throws. He's not as accurate. He seems not frazzled, but definitely there's pressure on him and he's having a little trouble adjusting to it. But when we get to that play, and he told Scott Van Pelt after the game that the way it was supposed to be is if he came out and he saw man-to-man, he was supposed to throw it. If he saw zone, he was supposed to run it. He got out there and he read both. He saw some elements of man-to-man, some elements of zone, and he decided, screw it. I'm going to put it on me and I'm going to make the play. And he made the play. And that's what's incredible about him. He does not back down from the moment. And you're right. It's a perfect description. He does. He runs like a baby giraffe. But a baby giraffe that has some power behind him. I mean, he is what, 6'5", 230-ish?
225, yeah.
225, okay. He's not a small dude.
No.
And if he hits you, you feel it. And he hit a Miami guy, and the Miami guy felt it. He went flying. So the way he executed it was amazing. The decision itself, I did not think was that much of a decision. I completely understood why Cignetti chose to do that and do it in that moment, because they don't really gain a lot by kicking the field goal. And so I thought it was the right choice. And then in the moment, Mendoza made the decision, I'm going to run it. And he executed it in Tim Tebow-ish fashion. And it's the reason why, you know, his legacy is forever cemented.
Yeah, I almost wonder if that the giraffe running style there, the baby giraffe running style, almost helped him out, because you could see that the safety on the play, he read it almost immediately. That's a giraffe. I don't know if he's reading the running back or if he was reading Mendoza, but he started screaming down hard, and there was a lane. You know, he Mendoza could have gone left. He could have run right in the safety. He kind of faked him out and went right. And I mean, Ahmad Moten had probably he had three shots to get Mendoza, and it was just grasping at air, you know, each time. And you know, it's funny, you know, Keelan Black, the running back, that was kind of they termed him the lead blocker on that play. I mean, they generously list him at 5'10" and 211. And you know, I was down there on the field and standing next to him, and 5'10" is generous with him. But man, he took on a guy. You know, the offensive line. You know, they really fired off on that ball. Talking with him afterwards, I mean, they said Cignetti, you know, after he called the timeout, and he was saying, you know, yelling at them, get back on the field, we're going for it. Like that fired them up, and you could see that. You know, in that initial blocking, you know, they really launched at the ball, and I mean, it is an iconic play. I mean, some of the kids afterwards, you know, they were saying like, let's, you know, whatever that they want to term that, you know, they were like, throw it up on the facilities. It needs to be done next week. We need to have that play up there. And it really was one of those iconic moments. You know, it was, you know, Vince Young scampering to the corner of the end zone in the Rose Bowl. You know, I think we will talk about that scramble in one of those iconic plays in college football. You know, that shot of him reaching for the end zone. You know, it's going to be on every book cover. I'm sure on the SI commemorative edition, that's going to be the lead image. You know, I mean, it.
Oh yeah.
Everything it, you know, came down to that. And you know, you talk about, we always joke about those Heisman moments. You know, during the regular season, you know, you got to have one of those plays that stands out. And they had a few during the regular season, but that one is the iconic image of this title run for the Hoosiers for sure.
Yeah, no doubt. And I did. I had a list of recent iconic plays that, you know, and this one, it's different. It's different. But the Vince Young run to the corner to beat USC 2006 BCS championship game, absolutely on there. Michael Dyer for Auburn not being down, spinning off the pile and running like 40 yards to set up the winning field goal for Auburn against Oregon. Deshaun Watson to Hunter Renfro was only a one-yard pass, but awfully memorable because there was 1 second left. Ezekiel Elliott, 85 yards through the heart of the South for Ohio State against Alabama in 2014. And then some of the great coaching decisions, the Boise hook and lateral, Saban's onside kick against Clemson. There's a bunch of them. So, you know, we'll history can sort out where it wants to put the Mendoza play, but it's absolutely among them. And so the statues, yeah, they're going to be in front of Memorial Stadium. If you've been to Indiana's campus, any of our listeners, they have a fantastic statue of like the whole starting five of the 1976 undefeated team. And really, it would kind of be appropriate to have like a team statue of this team. But I think you got to go with two of them. And you got to have Cignetti standing there with his hands on his hips and a scowl on his face, and his old headset on, and his head kind of cocked sideways, and his eyebrow up, because that's the way he looks throughout most of the game. And then you got to have the Mendoza leap. Those are the two statues I expect to see outside the Indiana football stadium at some point in time, whenever they get around to it. And I don't think they'll take long. The euphoria is a powerful motivator.
Well, and Pat, think of it this way too. I saw where the Miami DC said that they had a pretty good idea that play was coming, and he wished he would have called a timeout before the play to communicate better with his defense. You know, that's not unusual for coaches to say after the fact, but they weren't shocked by the play. And secondly, remember the other definitive, I mean, if we were going to do a statue, the other one we would have done was the throw against Penn State in the tap.
Omar Cooper. Yeah.
So, I mean, Mendoza was the difference maker, and he doesn't always look like the difference maker, run like the difference maker, but somehow he figures out a way when it matters most to rise to that occasion. So he did it and it deserved all the, 800 words you said you used in that, in your piece. Could have deserved more. I mean, it was that historic, important.
Then I did appreciate the fact that, Fernando, who is, you know, the absolute milk and cookies grandmother's favorite, you know, perfect guy.
Yeah, I know you're going to say.
That he actually dropped an F-bomb after the game.
He did, didn't he?
Let's effing go. There is a little bit of sass inside of that guy, inside of the choir boy. And it was funny, he was asked about it after the game, and he said, you know, we'd done it. We'd reached the pinnacle, and I'd spent all season basically giving these cookie cutter media coached answers. Well, now we've done it. I'm gonna go ahead and crow a little bit. So good for you, Fernando. Thank you for letting us see that side of you. Well, we also got to see, you know, the side. I was right there. It was right in front of me, and I mean, it almost choked me up. Him when he first got to his parents after the game. You know, and bending down and hugging his mother, Elsa, who's stricken with multiple sclerosis, is in a wheelchair. And then his father, Fernando, as well. You know, and Fernando, not senior, I think he's the third, and Fernando's the fourth or fourth and fifth. I don't know. But he was in tears, and he's hugging the grandparents. And just, I mean, you know, it was everything there. And that, you know, one of the most touching scenes, I think, throughout the playoffs, as everybody's gravitated to the Mendoza story, is when they show mom and dad is always sitting down next to mom. He's not standing up cheering. He wants to be with her on her level. That's this kind of this caring, you know, that I think with this family, you know, it just melts your heart. I mean, we are flinty, crusty, snide, jaded old sports writers. And I'm sitting there like, oh my gosh, I'm going to cry over Fernando. What the hell is this man doing to us?
He got up once, I think.
Did he? Okay.
He couldn't help himself, but he sat right back down. And you're right. It's love personified, and it's family personified, and those are, again, you know, you said at the very beginning, what makes this story so special isn't just that they won this game; it's all that is in the wrapper. And that family and that relationship and that moment, so private and yet so public, is just, you know, reason 1,431 why we love this whole Indiana experience.
Yeah, and you know, and extended to the rest of the team too. You know, I think that was what kind of struck me. You know, not being around Indiana as much as Pat has this season. After the game, you know, the student managers kind of blocked out, you know, Fernando's, you know, kind of locker, so he could have, you know, a little bit of his own space and his privacy. And you know, his dad kind of came in there afterwards and was getting a few of his things, you know, after the game as well. You know, you can see the embrace that he had, you know, with his brother on the end of the field, just you know, warming up. You know, I was watching him warm up, and I mean, he was just so focused on Alberto. and you know, trying to stay in the moment. You know, you just tell, you know, there was Tom Brady, there was Mark Davis and GM John Spytek from the Raiders. They're all like right there in the corner, you know, as Fernando's warming up and getting ready to go. And you know, he was zeroed in, and you know, the everybody was embracing him. Everybody there was not a single word that was not like, you know, over the top effusive praise for the guy, which, you know, I think that says a lot. I mean, this is a locker room full of 110 guys of, you know, a lot of different backgrounds, but man, he has won every single person over in red and white, from the fans to down into that locker room, and it was a special run, and it takes a special guy, you know, to get that over the line and do that.
Yeah, one of the things Cignetti said that I thought that was great, you know, is that, I mean, they have a great team bond, and it's evident. It is, you know, Aiden Fisher and Isaiah Jones and D'Angelo Pons and all these guys that are unbelievable teammates. He said, but sometimes you need one guy to be the cement to fill in all the cracks. And he said, Fernando's that guy unlike anybody I've ever seen before. So, again, the intangible elements of what made Indiana great are incredibly compelling. All right, let's just hit a couple other things, and then we will let Brian go to the airport in Miami and get on his way. Hey, did you know the Big Ten's won 3 in a row? Don't know whether you'd heard, but that actually happened. That has happened. That is happening. Three straight championships, 3 different teams. Michigan in 2023, Ohio State 2024, and Indy flip banana in 2025. Brian, you wrote about this, had some interchange with Tony Petitti. Is it the Big Ten sport now?
Well, they are certainly lording over it. They are on top, and they are saying it out loud. You know, I think that's been the biggest difference to me that I've noticed out of the Big Ten country is, look, you know, that first one when Tony Petitti was, you know, first at commissioner in Michigan, there was obviously a lot of, you know, external talk, if you will, surrounding that title with the Connor Stallions thing going on, the conference office's involvement in that story. I remember kind of watching Tony, you know, after that title game in Houston, and, you know, he kind of watched the trophy presentation and then just what, you know, no commented. Everybody made a beeline for some waiting SUVs, got out of there like, you know, it was nobody's business. And, you know, he last year in Ohio State in that run, you know, you could see him celebrate. You know, he was giving hugs to guys and, you know, he was on the stage, you know, which was, you know, a sharp difference from kind of his normally reserved personality. Well, this year,
yeah. Tensions were a little tight, high with Michigan in 2023. Yes.
Yeah, and I don't doubt that played a role. And you know, Ohio State, you could tell he was opening up more. But he would still, you know, try to stiff arm us in the media who were ask him for a comment or whatnot. This year, you know, he was trying to weave through everybody, trying to avoid all the celebrations and all that, trying to get on his way back to a few of his staff members at midfield. But he stopped. He stopped and talked, and he spent probably the longest I've ever spent getting a comment from Tony, and I've been outside those CFP meetings, you know, for years now. You know, he said 5 words on Sunday when it came to the format and all that about the playoff. Well, he was quite loquacious in saying this is only the beginning for the Big Ten. You know, which is not kind of the talk you'd typically have heard out of him. And you know, he spoke to this story, this being a great story. And it is a great story, not just for Indiana. It's a great story for the league. It's no longer Michigan and Ohio State carrying the banner for the Big Ten. I think having proof positive that a team like Indiana can not only win a national title, but go 16-0, make waves, make a turnaround like this, that means a lot for the Big Ten, and it means a lot for certainly their league partners. You know, Eric Shanks was there. He's an Indiana alum, the CEO of Fox Sports. You know, that was a big day for Fox Sports as well to have 3 straight Big Ten titles because they know what that means in terms of the ratings for next season. More people are going to be watching Indiana. More people are going to be watching Michigan. We're already seeing that increased investment, not just to keep up with Ohio State and Michigan in the league, but you're seeing, you know, USC pump in money. You're seeing Illinois pump in money. You're seeing Purdue change coaches, even though it might be costly to do that to bring in new blood. You know, you're seeing across the board in the Big Ten some progress, and you know, I think they're starting to crow about it up north of the Mason-Dixon line that this is their sport. They're starting to compete now, and I'm fascinated to see the existential crisis as it balloons further south of the Mason-Dixon line there in the SEC country, and how that reaction ends up kind of really defining the sport for these next couple of years as this Big Ten SEC Cold War starts raging.
Gene, you're in Knoxville. Are they panicking south of the Mason-Dixon?
I don't think they're panicking. I think you have to acknowledge the reality of it. It is three in a row, and if you look at next year, I think you could argue that Oregon, Ohio State, heck, I'm not going to bet against Indiana, though it's unbelievably hard to go back-to-back national champions. But if I've learned anything from Kurt Cignetti this year, it's not to doubt him. And you know, Brian mentioned USC, maybe that's another team. So they certainly have a lot of power at the top of the conference that could make it four in a row, possibly. But I don't believe that the SEC is simply going to cede the power of college football to the Big Ten. They're not giving up, and I could make a case for, you know, Georgia or Texas A&M next year to be a contender. So I don't think this argument is over, but there's no way you can ignore the facts. And the facts are the Big Ten's won three in a row, and it might win four in a row next year. So panic, no, but certainly there's work to be done in conferences such as the SEC that are used to being that conference. They're not that conference right now.
No, that's part of the paradigm shift to me.
Exactly.
It's not irrevocable, as you said. I mean, it doesn't mean the SEC isn't going to go back and have another run. But right now, the run is lopsided in favor of the Big Ten. And the other part of it is, you know, the SEC hasn't even had a team in the championship game the last 3 years. So that is pretty significant and a departure of, you know, them at least being around and in the hunt for a title, but not really the last 3 years. So,
fair point.
Yeah. I mean, it is what it is, and we'll go to SEC spring meetings, and I think it'll be time to ask those coaches there. Okay. I mean, they got some questions last year about it, but that's going to be the topic this time around. Although who knows, we will have drummed up some other ridiculous existential crisis in college football by then. But I, you know, I want to hear what they have to say. You guys are taking it on the chin from the Big Ten. What are you going to do about it?
But they're saying it already, Pat. Look at what Texas did during portal season. Look at the money that they spent. Look at the players they brought in. Look at what Texas A&M is spending. I think it's obvious. Look at what LSU has done. I think it's obvious that they know the days of the past where the SEC, you know, the way that it was built and the conference, the way it operated and the way that it won games, the way that it built programs. Cignetti's right. The paradigm has changed, and they're the ones that have to adjust now.
Yeah, they do. They need better coaching than what they have gotten in some places, like at LSU particularly comes to mind, but some other spots, Florida, for goodness sakes. I mean, what is going on at Florida?
Bama.
Bama, absolutely. The quarterback play, Auburn. Auburn has been a dumpster fire for 4 years. The quarterback play hasn't been as good. You know, you got Mendoza and Julian Sayin in the Big Ten this year. You had nobody near that caliber. Yeah. Dante Moore, absolutely.
Yeah.
So, you know, they've got some things they got to take care of. But to that point, Gene alluded to it, and we'll talk about this, and then we'll get out of here. We put out our way too early top 25 for 2026 because you're just not even a reputable website if you haven't taken a wild, ridiculous, irrational, irresponsible guess at what's going to happen a year from now. So we've got that out there. Brian Fisher, why don't you give us our top six or seven so that when we can briefly debate or give our thoughts, Gene and I, on what we think about it.
Well, I mean, to your point, you know, Ohio State number one, you know, they have Jeremiah Smith coming back. They have another Heisman finalist in Julian Sayin coming back. So, you know, the Buckeyes, as they continually do, really the last three decades, right? They continually reload. The tricky thing about putting this together is obviously you don't know the schedules for everybody. You know opponents, but I think we found that this year, the ordering of opponents, when you're playing byes, when you're playing back-to-back road games, especially in the Big Ten, given the travel concerns, you are kind of taking a stab in the dark. But I think a lot of people are going to be pretty confident putting Ohio State number one, just given what they have coming back. And let's face it, we know how they are when it comes to motivation, certainly going into the year, and how they can use that to fuel them on some of their CFP runs. Notre Dame is number two, Georgia number three, Texas number four. I think there was some consideration of for a lot of people, given what Texas has done in the portal, to put them back at number one in the preseason.
But we'll see how that goes, Pat.
Number five, Indiana, which, I think we had this debate obviously last year. Your initial formula had them in the top four. We put them at number five. They've got some new pieces, certainly. Oregon's up there at number six. We got Miami, who was just in the title game, returns a lot from this team. Certainly some question marks at key places at number seven. And I think we can probably cut the list off at number eight with Texas Tech.
Yeah, there you go. That's our completely wild guess there. I did just see, as a matter of fact, a report that one of the big things that Miami's got coming in is Darian Mensah from Duke at quarterback. Duke is apparently suing Darian Mensah for a breach of contract. So we'll see whether that has any effect on it. But Gene, do you got anybody you want to nominate number one for next year?
Well, I have Oregon, Notre Dame, Ohio State, IU, and Texas as my top five. And I was waiting to see what happened with Mensah and in Miami, but that would be my top five. I briefly, for a nanosecond, considered putting Texas at number one, but I could hear you already going, no, no, no. So I didn't do it. But given what Oregon showed me this year and what they have coming back, I'm willing to take a flyer on them as the way, 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 way too early number one for next season.
Yeah. The great thing about the way too early is we have many months to revise them, change them, and pump them back out for additional content. Briefly here to end the show, Gene Wojciechowski has done phenomenal work on the podcast all season, is signing off for now from the football side of things. The podcast will continue. I'm going to be at the Winter Olympics, so we got some things to figure out, but the podcast will continue. But Gino's a football guy. He's done great work for football. And I think you might have a book coming out too, Gene, that we need to flack for.
Yeah, if I can just get a credit card number from you, Pat, I'll put you down for some pre-orders.
Yeah.
It's a 100 book minimum, but with the money that you make, I'm sure it's no problem.
Yeah.
I do have a golf novel coming out shortly before the Masters. It's being published by Crown Publishing. It's called All Carry, which is sort of a term that is used in golf. And I hope people will look it up. It got a plug from John Grisham, of all people, if you can believe it.
That's good.
And it was a gas to write, and it's built around the idea of a set of magic clubs that were made for the great Jack Nicklaus that somehow find their way into the hands of a fired TV golf reporter. And so there's some a mixture of fiction and fact, but I took great pride in trying to make an authentic book that dealt with the world of caddies and television and father and son, and of course the Masters, which is where the book ends up. So thanks for letting me make a quick plug for it. And when we're done here, I'll just go ahead and get that credit card info from you.
Yeah, sure. Operators are standing by. I'm aware. No, it should be great. I look forward to it. All Carry, everybody, check it out.
Hey, and thank you, Brian and Pat, for letting me be part of this this podcast. And thank you to our production team and to our sponsors during the course of the season. It's been a gas. And I've really appreciated you guys letting me be part of it.
We've loved it. It's been awesome. And we hope this isn't goodbye for forever. That's for sure. But We will, we will be reconvening here in a reordered format at some point. Thank you to the listeners for all for a full season.
Absolutely.
Buying into our Exxon Valdez coverage of college football as we careened around, sometimes ineptly, but we tried to provide some insight, some information, and some laughs along the way. And we'll be back, I don't know, maybe next week. We'll see about that. But for now, thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you all later.
Comfort is often the first thing we're willing to give up, like taking a long flight for a vacation or waking up early for a workout. But don't let style be the reason you aren't comfy. Mack Weldon's Ace Collection makes it effortless to look put together while feeling truly comfortable. No compromises needed. For over a decade, Mack Weldon has designed pieces to keep you comfortable anywhere. Inspired by their best-selling sweatpants, the Ace Collection combines everyday comfort with long-lasting and confident looks. Upgrade your collection for the new year with new bomber jackets, half-zips, sweats, crewnecks, and much more. Mack Weldon clothes are designed to fit your style and the demands of modern life. They look like regular clothes, but feel like the latest in modern comfort. Get comfortable anywhere with the Mack Weldon's Ace Collection. Go to MackWeldon.com and get 20% off your first order of $125 or more with promo code MAC25. That's MACKWELDON.com. Promo code MAC25.